with the air. You know, as it's coming through the atmosphere, the air pressure itself will actually make this thing a 26-foot diameter thing. We're going to use the force of the air here and on Mars. Check back.
First student, 257. Coming straight to you tonight. Big bump in the gut.
Yes, thank you very much, Paul. And I can see how that inflatable saucer-shaped thing can be made larger and larger as long as you do it right, and still keep it stable as a drogue or as a velocity minimizer as you enter the Martian atmosphere. You did tell me that Voyager is 128 astronomical units away from the sun, which calculates that 93 million miles for one astronomical unit calculates to be 11.9 billion miles away. 11.9 even more like billion. That's called Sagan was a billion miles. So at the speed of light being roughly 300 million meters per second, it turns out to be at the speed of light, the radio signal you sent to Voyager takes 17.7 hours to get there one way. The round trip time of the signal going up and coming back down is 35 and a half hours. Man, that is a long delay length. Drop. That is by far the longest delay line mankind has ever worked on when it comes to real physical delay. Yeah, you can make artificial delay lines when you use some kind of a structure where the signal travels slower than the speed of light within your structure. But in a real delay line made out of speed of light material, free in space, 35 and a half hours. Say hello to Voyager. Talk to me. And Voyager says, I'm hearing you. 35 and a half hours for that signal to come back. I'm amazed at 8.5 gigahertz. You and I could calculate 8.5 gigahertz is a little bit more than inch and an eighth, inch and a quarter is a wavelength. You know my explanation of individual bubbles coming out of the transmitter. So each of these bubbles are only an inch and a quarter spacing between them. And to go that far and the signal doesn't get tired and to come back and be captured by the Goldstone dish and they're telling you how strong is the solar wind out there, whether or not Voyager has left the solar system. And I think they're reasonably sure out of the solar system, it's no longer seeing galactic wind coming from the sun when it drops. It's now seeing the so-called intergalactic wind, in other words, interstellar wind. It's now seeing the wind of other stars, possibly stronger than the solar wind, the particles being boiled up from the sun. And I believe you told me, Paul, that they are fairly sure that they will be continuing to communicate with Voyager up to the year 2022. And has anybody estimated how many astronomical units and what will the delay line be? Instead of 35 hours, is it going to be 50 hours round trip delay time to talk to it at that time? In fact, since we know how fast it's moving away, we can calculate that. And so that's an extremely good demonstration of the RTG radioactive thermal generator. In other words, there's a polonium-like material which is naturally radioactive, giving off heat. The thermocouples coupled to it, between it and the heat sink, is seeing a thermal difference, generating the voltage. And I think the whole spacecraft is now running on something like, is it 26 watts? Or is it 26 watts going to the transmitter? Run a couple of numbers by again, that's all. I took a job, I'm kind of fascinated with Voyager. WS2N, T2LIW, protect that.
WS2N, yeah, it was 24 watts was to the traveling wave tube. That's the last I heard about a year or so ago. Well, we got the 35 and a half hour round trip for Voyager 1 for the radio wave. Which fascinates me, by the way. The idea that you could send, you know, you send a code. I want the thing to, you know, send another measurement back to the Earth, send some code, zeros, ones, and zeros, and you transmit it away, you know, on your computer, and then, you know, you say, what am I going to do tonight? I'm going to go out, I'm going to have dinner, go home, take a nap, and maybe I'll go to sleep, come back tomorrow morning, and, you know, 35 hours later, I mean, you're not transmitting, there's no more signals going, leaving the antenna, it's already been done, and it's flying, you know, everything, you know, all the way past Pluto, maybe four times the distance of Pluto, but here's this invisible wave going along, and yet it's not even being received by the Voyager. It's a 17 hour trip, you know, 5 hours later, it's still going, and yet it didn't get there. That's fascinating to me, and then sooner or later, it hits the year. The antenna on Voyager. Here's that time period when there's no electronics being operated, no transmitter, no receiver, just flying through space, eventually going to get there. I find that amazing. A couple of other questions you asked about the RTG. Let me drop it. The radioisotope thermoelectric generator. It's three on each craft. They really want a redundancy, three of them on each Voyager, and it's still operating. So, and if there was another question, it's gone out of my head. Back to you.
And like you said, it's just hard to imagine. You transmit a signal, you give the hold on message, you end the signal, it's a great big pulse of energy that you can transmit the signal for 10 minutes. We can calculate how far a signal travels at speed of light in 10 minutes, some number of millions of miles, from the leading edge to the trailing edge of the message you're sending, and that whole packet of energy with that many miles of thickness is all going out into space and eventually hits Voyager, and it responds. And if it responds immediately, 35 and a half hours later, you get the answer. So how long a signal you can make between the beginning and the end, and it hasn't gotten there yet. From your transmitting point of view, you stop, and now you wait around and wait for an answer. That's the length. And I did the opposite when I was doing that work at Edwards Air Force Base at the Benfield Anechoic Facility. I was generating pulses that were, make sure this is, my processors turned on. The pulses were 1/4 of 1 nanosecond long.
I remember the other question.
Okay. 1/4 of a nanosecond long, which means that the beginning of the signal that I'm transmitting on each individual pulse, 1/4 of a nanosecond long, versus the end of the signal, light at the speed of light, the signal has only gone 4 inches during that time. So if you could see the pulses coming out of that transmitter, from the leading edge to the trailing edge of the pulse of RF energy at 10 gigahertz was only 4 inches thick. And that pulse went out into the chamber, found the thing that was echoing, and came back. So that was a radar with a range resolution of 4 inches. And that was transmitting 1 millionth of those pulses per second. And various people thought that was a crazy idea. Turned out to work fairly well. I got a bunch of awards for that one. So, well, what was the other thing that I asked that I already forgotten about, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW.
Okay, very good. The speed and how much, the year, they said 2025, I think is the long-range prediction. It will be, hopefully they'll hear from it that long. The speed was roughly 40,000 miles per hour, away from the sun. And to think of in a time frame of a year without doing all the math, it's easier to memorize 3.5 AU per year, 3.5 times. That's the easiest thing. 3.5 AU every year. So you can add them all up, you're at 128 now, you go another, 5 more years, you're going to get, maybe 18, 19 more AU out of the deal.
that's why I wanted to mention. And as far as the radio wave traveling along, you know, remember the first time you heard, well, when, you know, you got to go way back, you heard that if the sun was going to go out right now, let me drop it. Sun was going to just all of a sudden stop. We're going to be sitting on the beach and still soaking in the sun's rays for the next 8 minutes. That was a fantastic thought, you know. You just can't, you know, mentally, well, I can't anyway, picture the sun ever going out. But here's this radio wave transmit, you know, 1 minute transmission to Voyager. And you know, if they are doing it, you either turn the machine off, turn off the transmitter, walk away from it, spin the antenna around, it doesn't matter anyway. You put the antenna in the opposite direction, it doesn't matter. And here's this radio wave just traveling away for, you know, hours on end, you know, and they're actually doing it. So I find that fascinating. Back to you, then.
It's not too different from what Robert Goddard ran into. He was the first guy to experiment with liquid-fueled rockets. And he was writing articles talking about how his rockets were eventually going to be used in space. And New York Times newspaper ridiculed the daylights out of him and said, didn't you realize that the rocket engine has to push against air? And when you're in space where there's no air, you're not going to get any thrust anymore. There's no air to push against. That was on the New York Times article about the proposals that Robert Goddard was writing in those days. And he was really being ridiculed in ways that are unreasonable. Everyone has forgotten about Newton's third law of action and reaction. The exhaust of your rocket engine is sending out material that has a certain amount of mass, and it's coming out of that exhaust nozzle at the rocket engine nozzle at a certain number of 1,000 miles an hour velocity, and that represents momentum. So the main thing a rocket engine does is to take massive energy, massive material, accelerate it, and sending away from you, and that creates thrust. And whether or not you're pushing against air when you're doing that makes very little difference. So by the same token, you and I send out a radio signal. We assume the radio signal is being continuously pushed out by the transmitter and the antenna. Not at all. That signal that you issued a microsecond ago or a nanosecond ago, that event is thoroughly independent. That signal is going out there, and whether or not you continue to transmit for the next nanosecond, the next microsecond, or the next hour, doesn't matter. That original signal you transmitted, all by himself, he's going to go out there. It kind of defies common sense at first, doesn't it, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, it certainly does. That brings me back to that. That's one of the reasons I asked about the Yagi. Was, you know, you have 10 watts, and it turns out you'll get probably 3 watts into the director. You know, I was thinking to myself, here's this dipole, if that thing shut off, and then, you know, a nanosecond later, next thing you know, this other piece of metal is lighting up, you know, the director. Here it is, creating 3 watts. Meanwhile, the other one is off. So it's almost like you're getting, in fact, you're just getting free wattage, you know. Instead of your transmitter going directly to that antenna and putting out 9.9 or whatever, a little bit too. So let's call it 10. Let's say it's actually going out at 10. You know, in the real world, you now have 13 going that way. That's the same idea, right? Back to WS2N.
Yeah, one of the first things I thought about from your question, Paul, was that I know about the inverse square law. Every time you double the distance between your transmitting antenna and your receiving antenna, you will experience 6 dB more insertion loss, 4-to-1 ratio. Whatever power you were getting, double the distance, you're going to get 1/4 of that power, 6.02 dB less. So I could now work that backwards. I could move the director as a receiving element closer and closer to the driven element, and by the inverse square law, calculate how strong the signal is going to be to catch. That dipole has a near field range, I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess it's in the vicinity of 1 foot. I think it's around 1 foot in the near field range. And that director, that 915 megs, is only 3 inches away. So it's way inside of the near field range. As such, when you're making measurements that close, you can no longer measure directly, you can no longer measure antenna patterns, you can no longer independently calculate by inverse square law signal strength. All of that goes down those tubes when you're in the near field range. And in fact, when you're only 3 inches away, you're probably inside of the reactive near field range. That means you're really getting, let me drop, you're getting the effect of a couple of other kinds of coupling mechanisms. The tips of the dipole and the tips of the director are close enough together that capacitive coupling effects are starting to dominate. The center of the dipole that's got a strong magnetic field and the center of the director, which has got a strong magnetic field, is getting magnetic coupling. You could call one of them the primary coil of the transformer and the other the secondary coil. So you're getting magnetic coupling, electrostatic coupling, capacitive coupling. You're getting other kinds of coupling effects. And therefore, if you plot signal strength versus distance, it is not inverse square law when you're that close. It starts going to inverse third, fourth, fifth law, and so other sets of rules start working, and therefore there's a kind of mathematics where it could be predicted, but it's not the simple mathematics of the inverse square law, is the main point I wanted to make. And all the things that's going on at the molecular level, and again, you can tell by what I've said up till now, let me drop this. I've got a couple of mental diagrams that tell me approximately what's happening. Just like Mr. Thompson, way back in the beginning of studying nuclear energy, he had a mental image of what does a molecule or what does an atom look like, with the nucleus in the center and the electrons going around as if they're orbits like the planets going around the sun. And in the beginning, that model worked. They eventually found that it's a much more complicated way that the electrons move, because those individual planets going around the sun really don't see each other. But those individual electrons are only a fraction of a micron, a fraction of an angstrom apart from each other. They've got very strong electrostatic repulsion. Therefore, they affect each other as something fierce. And therefore, their individual orbits, so to speak, are a lot more complicated. So, some of these phenomena are taking place in that director and reflector of that gas. At the molecular level, there's a lot more going on. My mental model sort of works for me, but I know darn well it's not the whole story. That's S2M, K2LIW.
Barry, and then let me reset. Very good. Well, I know it was some kind of, reduction of power, whatever it was, but what it was, I don't know. But let's forget the example of one guy. What was his name? He'll know it. He'll go to the thing. He thought with the letter G, last name, G is Gulf. I'll think of it later. Maybe you'll think of it. But he had the antenna on the stage. And the other guy was like 10, 15 feet apart. He pointed his Yagi at this guy, and I think he was running like 20 watts or something. And the guy had a light bulb, and it was an incandescent light, a small little like flashlight bulb. It wasn't neon or anything. He threw alligator clips on it, attached it to the other antenna. This ain't gonna work. Sure enough, the guy points the antenna at this was a directional antenna. He points the Yagi at the other guy's antenna, and his light bulb lights up. That was a cool demo. And actually, they did the other part where they did take a fluorescent bulb, it was actually a neon bulb, and they went toward the end of the antenna, and the receiving antenna was going to light up. He was showing the difference between the amperage in the center and the voltage on the end. Back to you, sir.
I'm very unhappy that I can't think of his name either. That guy that gave the demonstration that you saw about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, he is a member of a four-generation ham radio family on Long Island. And the latest guys are Limoch members. We talk to them periodically, and also I can't think of their call letters or names. Somebody else, somebody on here has got to pick up who I'm talking about. KQLIW. It'll come to us later, but that was a very effective demonstration. So my guess is that that incident of time was when you were watching that demonstration, Paul, I bet you suddenly developed a brand new faith in what a Yankee antenna can do. How can something so simple, just a couple of hunks of, it could be made out of a coat hanger wire, and the bulb could be a simple slab of wood. So a couple of pieces of a coat hanger wire sitting on a piece of wood, a slab of wood, can do all that magic. I bet that instant of time, it sort of suddenly fell in love with what a Yankee antenna is and what it can do. Is that roughly true, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. You got to remember, I was, it was probably the late 1980s, you know, so I was pretty new there. You know, I came in, what, 1986, so probably a year or two after that. And to see that at that point, you know, that borderline on magic, as far as I'm concerned. Von Stilber, I believe. I can't remember the guy's name. We have enough listeners. I know somebody's going to come up. I'm pretty sure he's a silent key now, but you know, he's no good at that point. I think I remember somebody saying he passed away.
Yeah, that very famous guy did pass away, but his son, grandson, and great-grandson are now active members. We talk to them periodically. He lived out in the Shoreham area, as I remember. We hear him on the, the third generation guy. He's a deep sea diver. We hear him periodically. And then, because I haven't talked to him in some time, and I'm so darn forgetful, I've forgotten him. We will resurrect that name for you guys. Hang in there. Paul and I, things like this bug these old guys when we forget things. So, Paul's going to be thinking about it. I'm going to be thinking about it sometime in the next minutes, hours, or days. That name will come back to us, and we'll be telling you who it was. So, that was a very well-done demonstration. In fact, the very first guy who demonstrated waveguide in front of the, was then called the IRE, Institute of Radio Engineers, before it became the IEEE. He did a somewhat similar demonstration. Had a great big large piece of tubing, not too different from downspout tubing, so to speak, for the gutter of the house, but a larger version of it. And he demonstrated how we could put a microwave signal into one end and bring it out the other end. And the fact that there was no center conductor there, because the signal went through anyhow. The way waveguide works, the transmission line that has no center conductor, a single conductor transmission line, and there's two different kinds. The hollow pipe waveguide, rectangular, round, or elliptical, or many other kinds of shape, works very well. And there's also another kind of one-dimensional transmission line called a G-line, Gaboon line, where we're very careful of launching the signal with a great big cone-shaped device. There's ways you can launch a signal on a single piece of wire, a microwave signal, as long as it's got the right coating of dielectric material on the wire. And that's another kind of reasonably low-loss transmission line. Okay. Thank you, Paul. And take those messages for you, Dick. Go ahead, John. Somebody sending a message to the Echo Link. You got it, John.
Yeah, Bill, H2IS, he would like you to know that St. Paul is describing a re-entry vehicle, paraglider.
That's the word I was looking for. So there is a YouTube video of a guy flying a very large paraglider. And you can see it becoming unstable. He was going through slightly rough winds, and periodically it was collapsing. And the guy took his standby secondary parachute and launched it simultaneously, and there was a slow descent. And he was wearing a camera on the head of his helmet, on the top of his helmet. And you see him coming down to the ground with all of his hardware twisting and folding in the breeze. And eventually, the main paraglider twisted about five times, twisted up all of its lines, and it was starting to collapse. So he had a close shave, as I see it. You can't hear all of his, you can't make sense of what he's saying, because it was a guy speaking in Oriental language. He was also wearing some kind of a radio. Somebody was talking to him continuously on the way. But it does demonstrate to me that large paragliders, large parachutes, anything as large, has more than one mode in which the wind can reflect inside of it, and therefore it is capable under certain conditions to become unstable. And so all that great slow descent rate could suddenly go down the tubes, and you can become very unhappy from these larger devices that, that things don't go right. And over in Westland, do well.
Our first pickup works, UPS, let it drop it.
Rich also is trying to tell us a message by way of Echo Link. John, go ahead.
Yeah, just let it drop and we'll pick it up. Hit UPS.
Hi, thanks, John. I think you're talking about is Bob Greenberg, W2CYK, and his son Jesse. I don't know your grandfather's name, but that's who you were trying to think of.
Well, John, Greenberg is the name. Does that name sound familiar to you, Paul? And now, the call letters and the first name of Greenberg, who's now a silent key, who gave you that demonstration, we got to come up with his name yet. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, I heard Greenberg. What was his first name? I remember it was a G, so yeah, I'm pretty sure that, that rings the bell, Greenberg. What was his first name, Dick?
Yeah, I think Rich just told us that. K2UPS, K2RIW. Tell us the names. Jesse is the youngest one, and I can't remember the names of the others, but it's a four-generation ham radio family on Long Island. K2UPS, K2RIW.
That's correct, Dick, and I believe Jesse has the grandfather's call sign, W2IEE, maybe? I forget what it is offhand, but I'm pretty sure he has the grandfather's call sign. I don't know what the grandfather's name was, but the father right now is Bob Greenberg, Robert Greenberg, and his son is Jesse, in case of UPS.
Well done, Rich. I will eventually think of the grandfather's name. And his call letters. We'll get that eventually. But well done demonstration. My guess is you saw that demonstration at maybe Radio Central or Suffolk County Radio Club. Was it one of those, Paul? WF2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, and they held it out in Stony Brook. So that's where I saw it. But he did this demonstration in a number of places. You know, that was the only time I know he did it. Did before and he did it after.
Comment, please. Comment, go ahead.
This is Kilo 1, Mike, Julian, Mike. Mike, relating to your gag conversation a little bit earlier, there's a really nice video on YouTube by a little Asian girl named Diana Eng, E-N-G is her last name. That's Diana E-N-G. And if you Google Diana Eng gag, she actually built a four-element gag, and she scans it with a neon bulb light. Paul was talking about before showing the bulb light up. And she starts with a dipole and builds it into a four-element gag and shows how it works. K1SAM, back over to you.
Thank you, Mike. Mike, K1MJM, the guy you just heard, is the second guy of the group that I call Mike and Mike. He's the second guy with the website. He runs the website called LimeOnTechNet.com. LimeOnTechNet.com? Yeah, .net.com. Okay, so that looks like a good website to go to. Also, if you Google my call letters, you'll eventually get a whole bunch of pictures that somebody put onto the internet. And one of those pictures is a Japanese lady, a Japanese girl, looks to me like she's about 10 years of age, 8 years of age, and she's holding up above her head a 19 element yet, which just happens to have two reflectors on it. I recognize that design. I got to find out who she is. And I am curious about whether or not she could possibly be an offspring of JA9DOH. JA9DOH was one of the guys who did some moon bounce with the Agnes of My Design way back a couple of decades ago when Stanford University was loaning their 150-foot dish to the local ham radio operators for moon bounce operations. Okay. I thank you, everyone, for all this information. More to follow. I know that Wes wants to discuss a particular subject, so go right ahead, Wes. And 2XJN, KQIIW in the TechNet.
Something to think. Here we go.
WHCDO.
I wasn't even had a chance to look at the media that I asked for, and then shortly I was having two questions about the project. It's a set of coils over there, which would be the interaction and the pressure, but it's a bit short at the end of it, and it's a coil that has a capacitor in parallel, but it's not connected anywhere. I appreciate it.
Okay, we're going to get that in a second. Andy, the BGCDL, you want to make a message, a transmission?
Yeah, good evening. I just turned the radio on. I can't stay. I heard a question regarding an antenna that had a light bulb connected to it that would give a different brilliance of light depending on the number of elements.
The Yagi
antenna or beam antenna.
Are
you talking something about that? About a demonstration?
With me. Yeah, it's only coming back to Art Greenberg, who is the name of the grandfather of this fourth generation ham radio family on Long Island. And Art Greenberg, way back, roughly in the 1917 time frame, was going around to ham radio clubs, and maybe you were one of the guys that saw his demonstration, Paul W2N was, where a simple antenna had a light bulb connected to the antenna. The antenna was set up some number of feet across the room. And T.R. Greenberg had this Yagi antenna that was transmitting the signal. And as he aimed the Yagi antenna toward the antenna with the light bulb, he saw the light bulb light up. And by waving that antenna back and forth, you were getting an optical demonstration of the Yagi antenna pattern. That's what I think Paul was describing. Art Greenberg, I believe, is the name of the guy that was doing that demonstration. See if Paul is still there. Is that the right name? I think we're slowly arriving. We know everything now except his call is WS2N, K2LIW.
That's it, Art. Nate Art. Yes, that's Bob. Very good. That's definitely him. I remember that name. Back to you then.
And Andy, WHCDL, I wonder if you were one of the privileged guys that saw that demonstration. The
WHCDL, KQIIW. Actually, no. But I saw another demonstration given by Walter Wenzel, KA2RGI, who was a member of the Great South Bay. He did a demo at Limemark a number of years back and a few other locations. What he did is he just took a dipole antenna and had I don't remember the exact configuration, but he had a small, like a number 47 pilot light connected to the dipole, but then he added an extra element as making it into a beam, a director and a reflector, and you could see the brilliance of the light bulb change. It got brighter as he added the elements to it. This is on the antenna itself. He did not point the antenna to another antenna. This is the
exact antenna he was using. That was a demonstration that Walter gave that I saw. Back to you. And when those guys are giving their demonstration with the Yagi-like structure, they could, if they wanted to, go one step further. While the Yagi is operating, if they touched the tip of the individual director's and/or driven element and/or reflector, which, by touching it, you're adding capacitance to the tip, tuning it to a lower frequency, you're bringing it out of the frequency region where it's doing its work, and you would see the light bulb gets dimmer. In other words, you can easily measure the effectiveness of each element by touching it. And I do a more sophisticated version of that when I'm tuning the ID, because at the end of a long wooden stick, a skewer, I put a piece of copper tape, and as I bring the piece of copper tape near the tip of an element, it adds tip capacitance, turning it to a lower frequency. And if the performance of the ID increases or decreases in either direction, it's telling you a useful piece of information, telling you what you should do next with that element. If bringing a piece of copper tape near it makes it work better, then you know that the element wants to be made physically longer. And if it works worse, then you know that element wants to be made physically shorter. It's a little bit like a sight of bad person walking up a hill. By the tilt of his feet, he knows which direction is uphill. And by waving pieces of copper tape near the elements of the yag, it tells you which direction is uphill to get more gain when we drop them.
U2LH is that call sign for our That's from Rich, UPS.
Well done. That's the 2LH. 2LH, Art Greenberg. Is it suddenly coming back, Paul, to press 2N, K2LIW?
I don't remember the call. I remember the name, though. What was it, W2LH?
That's what we were told by Rich, K2UPS. And we're getting that answer from the Philadelphia area, or at least it was Philadelphia area, an hour ago. By now, he's probably in Harrisburg. There's a way I could find out. We could track him. We know where to send the cruise missile if we wanted to stop him from transmitting information. Okay. So, yeah, the Greenberg family are ham radio operators from way back. Four generations, if I remember correctly. At least three, and I think it's four generations of Long Island ham radio operators. I think that my family only has two generations. I think the Greenberg family, Bob Greenberg, tells us there are very few four-generation families. I think American Radio Relay keeps track of those, and I believe he's one of the very few four-generation. Don't know if anybody knows of a five-generation ham radio family. Think you are, W. listening.
All right. Well, let me just find out, because I got to get up early. Just wanted to pin that comment, and you can get it back to Wesley, because you only have about 20 minutes left, I guess. Thanks, Dick. WCDL, I'll talk to you.
Great
finding.
And good luck to Bob. I guess you're going back to work. Wes, no, I didn't get a chance to see it. You're going to have to describe it to me. I do know that you're taking a coaxial cable, putting either a capacitor or a short circuit across the tail end of it, the outside end of it, wrapping it on a coil form. I know that that coil form also contains another coil of wire with a capacitor across it, which is a resonant network. I believe you're looking for the coupling coefficient between the coaxial cable and that coil. And as it's described to me, and as I saw it in the first video, I think that the amount of coupling is going to be very small, because when coax cable is working correctly, almost all of the signal is on the inside of it, and very little is on the outside. And unless if you do something wrong with the antenna so that it doesn't have the right kind of a balancing structure, or if you do something funny with the way you terminate the coax, so under normal circumstances, all the signal is self-contained. And even though the coax is part of a coil, the signal going down the center doesn't know that. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yes, Richard. The frequency of operation is about 15 to 20 kHz. The carpet coaxial may look a little bit different than surface match coaxial cable and surface 78 coaxial cable, whatever you say about it. We have L3 on the schematic, which is the coaxial cable coil, but then on the same form we have L2, which is the coil and the capacitor. Not coming to India. Now, we're trying to tune the capacitor with the coil L2 to the frequency of resonance, which is the frequency of resonance of L2. conductive reactions and capacitive reactions that exist at that time in resonance, what would be the coupling of this discuss any coupling ever? You have an L, a glacial cable bouncing wave, which would be back and forth because there is no match of the heat. Enter it.
Yeah, when you look at the center conductor diameter and the outer conductor diameter of a coax cable, there is a formula, 136 log A over B, tells you indeed if and only if you're at a high enough frequency where the skin depth does not become close to the depth of the actual outer braid. If you start going down to very low frequencies, like 15 or 20 kilohertz, the real impedance of the coax cable is a different number, and because the skin depth is starting to be greater than the shielding, the braid thickness, there is now the possibility of some signal leaking out of the coax cable. So now there is a mechanism by which the coax cable could be coupling to your external coil that's wrapped with it.
Would it be possible that it could act like a capacitor?
Well, you talked about the signal bouncing back and forth in the coax. You've got to be careful now with that. If the signal generator was a pure 50-ohm signal generator, the signal would not be bouncing back and forth multiple times. The signal would go down the cable, hit the short circuit, come back, and when it hits the signal generator, if the signal generator is 50 ohms, the signal becomes thoroughly absorbed. If the signal generator is far from 50 ohms, now you've got a condition where the signal bounces back and forth, and now, depending on the length of the coax cable, you could run into some resonance-like phenomena. But when you're down to a frequency as low as 15 or 20 kilohertz, where the wavelength is now miles long, and you use a coax cable that is not miles long, you're not going to get a resonance bouncing phenomenon. And second of all, let me drop the other coil. If you want the other coil to resonate for 15 to 20 kilohertz, most signals, most inductor resonator, what am I looking for now? Most hole is the right word. A resonator to resonate at 15 to 20 kilohertz usually consists of a coil of multiple millihenry, lots and lots of turns to get enough inductance, unless you're using a huge capacitance, in order to resonate at a frequency of 15 to 20 kilohertz. It's a very large diameter coil, or multiple turns of the coil, like a 2.5 millihenry RF choke. So getting resonance that low is quite different than the normal radio signals that we work with. Now, when it comes to the coil that you want to resonate, as long as you know the diameter that the coil is wound on, the number of turns, and the spacing between those turns, in the radio amateur's handbook, in the first couple of chapters, there is a formula where you can plug in those numbers, and it'll tell you exactly how many microhenry or millihenry of inductance that that coil is going to give you based on its geometry, diameter, number of turns, spacing of turns. And so, from there, you can calculate the exact, or very close to the exact inductance of the coil, and therefore, you can calculate how big a capacitor is required across that coil to hit resonance. I wonder if you've looked at that chapter yet, Wes. It's going to help. That's Wes 2N, K2LIW.
Yes,
that's true.
No, I didn't look at this particular chapter. What I was trying to do is actually use your hub to analyze not only pressure cable interaction with something like capacitor coil connected together, not connected anywhere, but also the complex of the coils, because you have two more coils there, and eventually get some ideas of what's going on. Interesting.
Let me ask you, what is the overall motivation? Do you want the signal that's propagating down the center of the coax cable to couple to the coils? The coils, do you want them to couple to each other? And do you want to see an increase in voltage or current based on resonance. So what is the motivation here, Wes, in 2XJN, K2LAW?
The motivation is explaining how the device works. Schematic is all the device that is supposed to couple to itself, and eventually there is a durable electrostatic pump which will explain how the device works. Let's drop.
Yeah, let's drop long enough to make sure the machine resets, because right now the eastern link is not working.
Yeah, it's complicated. There is a pretty much good theory and also practical devices that explain how electrostatic pump works like. There is also an inertia of the electron that is associated with it. I'm trying to make one logical piece of explanation out of everything, but at first, I would love to have your help in analyzing the set of the coil itself. What I suggest to do is, let's say we leave the discussion to next week, and if you have a chance, just to look at two videos. They are short videos. The first video is extremely explanatory. We show the device. It uses one impulse from the battery, then activates upper and lower impulse forming circuitry, and then the end of that device, the output of the device, that fancy coil. This coil produces 220 volts at the output to power up the light bulb, but at the same time that voltage is being used to power up the down converter, or say the power supply that it makes from 220 back the 12 volts. And the 12 volts DC is back used to power the device again. So the battery is being used only for one single impulse. I know it sounds insane, but you asked me for it. The theory is that the electrons are. It's funny. The source of drag from the plant is that I'm trying to explain by the term of electrostatic pump. As a matter of fact, such a pump exists, and it creates a number of phenomena. If you go to dust, iron acoustic, and acoustic instabilities. The abstract of the phenomena, then ion in the Wikipedia, and electron and inertia, you would see plenty of the explanation. There are actually pumps that exist already, and they could pump anything from air to fluid to particles based on ion. So I is created by the both chemical and physical means, could be described as some of them were ionized and some of them are not yet. And if atom gains electrons, it has a negative charge, and that it will try, due to its own motion, to pull part of the atoms that are still neutral. Now you're creating ions movement. So that would be like you're creating an inertia in between the ion. What is ion? Ion is uneven atom. Enter here.
Now, when it comes to the inertia of electrons, as I mentioned last week, I think we're going to discover that they're amazingly small. Electrons in a wire are really like marbles in a piece of tubing. You push one marble into the front end of the tubing, another marble pops out of the other end. And so the distance between the two and the speed at which that happens looks like it occurs in a nanosecond per foot. I mean, if there's 3 feet of length on that cable between my battery and my starter motor, at the instant the switch closes on the solenoid of the starter motor, 3 nanoseconds later, the battery knows about the current train. But it isn't because an electron had flowed all the way from the battery to the starter motor. It's a different set of electrons, if you know what I mean. And so, at the 200 ampere rate, it takes 4 hours for that electron to get from the battery, electron number 5, so to speak, to get all the way to the starter motor. So, electrons, under normal circumstances, are really moving very slow, and yet the effect they have is very fast because of the marbles in the pipe. So, the electrostatic pump, I know that you would like to have extra energy coming out of ground. You would like to have the inertia of the electrons that have been set into motion to be part of what carries through. And various people in this circumstance can come up with theories of operation like that. But when you boil down to the more realistic numbers of how heavy is an electron, how many of them are there, how fast are they moving, I'm having trouble believing that electron kinetic energy is going to be a significant portion of the operation of the circuit. Mass to energy ratio of an electron, yes, with an oscilloscope, the way it deflects the electron beam going towards the phosphor, you can measure their charge to mass ratio. And I think you're going to find out that mass is an extremely small number. And I believe you're calling this an electron pump, and I think you would like it to excite a signal that's on one of the resonating coils to be considerably larger than the signal that's coming out of the signal generator. And by way of resonance, let me drop this. If I just take ordinary coupling technique between a signal generator and a coil, and because of the coupling coefficient that I've chosen, and because of the inert natural Q of the resonator, I can, in theory, I can build a resonator with a Q of 1,000. And if I lightly couple a transmission line to it, I can have that resonator multiply the voltage of my signal generator by 1,000. One of the definitions of Q is voltage rise at resonance or current rise at resonance. So I can get 1,000 times more voltage out of that resonator when I properly couple to it. However, it's not 1,000 times more energy. The energy of the coil, in almost all cases, is going to be lower than the signal coming out of the signal generator.
It's not that easy answer, as you say, because we're dealing with traveling an electron through different media. Electrons can have very wide variety of speeds. Could be a slow case where the electron moves when the current flow in the wire, but the speed of those electrons themselves to move the wire, that would be actually the drift velocity. Could be a 0.2400 of the centimeters per second. Almost, yeah, extremely slow.
Hold on now. Tell me what you're going to do to make electrons in a wire move faster than the millimeters per minute. What are you going to do with electrons in a wire to make them move fast? The electron beam in free space from the cathode to the phosphor of a cathode ray tube, those electrons move fast, but very few of them. But the electrons in a wire tend to move very slow. What are you going to do to make the electrons in the wire move fast? Over to you, Wes.
No, it's not really about the wire. It's about the whole phenomena as a complex. Bohr model of hydrogen atoms. which has about electrons zipping around the nucleus about 2 million meters per second. It's very fast, right? Some samples are, say, beta particles. Beta particles are electrons, which are emitted from by some radioactive material. And even most electrons of an atom of element have a large atomic number. You could talk about uranium. So it indicates the electrons traveling at very nearly the speed of light, about 200 million meters per second. So depends on the medium. And then when we were talking about the hydrogen, it is difficult to find hydrogen. So what I'm trying to say is we have the electrostatic field at very high voltage. It's 100,000 of volts. Then we have ionized particles. And it's the right phenomenon of the happening of a deer. That's why I could go over, but I have only probably 0 seconds left. It would be so kind to look at it for the next week. I'll be more prepared just to discuss that and formulate the questions. That's what it is.
Okay. When I do look at the video number one and video number two that you mailed me, will the motivation be described? In other words, a phenomenon is going to be described. Is the motivation going to be described? Now, the overall motivation to get a buildup of voltage, a buildup of current, a buildup of velocity, a buildup of energy, a different amount of energy flowing in versus flowing out. What is the major motivation of this particular experiment, Wes? And 2XJN, K2RIW?
The major motivation is explaining how is it possible. If it's possible, that this device could use one simple, single, 1 second impulse, and then work without any power supply at all. If it's possible. And not going to go in here to all of this stuff like we discussed with John. There are plenty of people who actually have this device with right now. But anyhow, say everybody's lying. Everybody is not true. What I'm trying to find out is what actually the processes are happening from this perspective in a coil test. In the first video, it's being called part number two. It is extremely short, about 5.5 minutes, explanation of all of the blocks, how the blocks work, how the signal is going and where it's going and what it's doing. We know that this device doesn't work without the ground. But it could work if there is a counterpoint. We know that we have ionization over here. And then I have, on my side, at least experience from the past when I saw TK with his device and I saw the Lithuanian experiment. And I was surprised that from few milliwatts of generators after the losses, I was able to see 600 watts light bulb that was lighting in front of me. So, you know, there must be something here of, you know, six people in the room were absolutely delusional. And of course, in Tbilisi, Georgia, I was also delusional. And everything is hoax. Now I have another invitation to Latvia and to Israel.
Yeah, you've gone to one or two demonstrations. You're about to go to another one. And I think you're probably going to make a pretty serious effort to build one for yourself. And you would like to see it operating in Queens. That's my guess.
I'm working on Coleman. I invest so much money and I get so much effort, I have so much fun. It doesn't matter if it's going to work or it's not going to work. I've seen 3 watts already light up when everything was switched off in the house. And here it is.
Okay, so it sounds like you're starting to see the desirable result, and is that desirable result repeatable as many times as you would like to repeat it, Wes? Go ahead.